On the agenda today, we have four hearings, and the executive appointments will not be heard today. First of all, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3272. Jim.
Yes, Madam Chair, 3272, House Bill 3272A adjusts the boundaries of Linn County with its adjacent counties Benton, Lane, Marion, and Polk counties. So I have no amendments proposed for this one.
Okay. First on the sign-up sheet, we have Roger Nyquist and Mark Nelson. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Just please introduce yourself for the record and whichever one of you is going to begin first.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chairs. For the record, Roger Nyquist, Albany, Oregon, Linn County Commissioner on behalf of Linn County this afternoon. I can be as simple and straightforward or as technical and complicated as you would like. I will attempt the simple and straightforward first. How about okay. that? House Bill 3272 we view as the updating of an existing 150-year-old statute that clarifies and specifies center of the river means center of the river. I handed a packet out to you, and first on that list would be the existing statute in the top right-hand corner of that. And it talks about the county boundary commencing in the middle of the Willamette River at the southeast corner of Polk County, thence running south along the main channel of such river to the middle fork thereof, and it goes on. And it's in 1850 was probably a fairly good statute. What it didn't say is center of the river as of 1850. It didn't say that the boundary would move, in fact, when the river moved. And over the years, different folks have interpreted the statute differently. Some interpreting it to be the river as it existed in 1850. Others have not. There have been various handshakes and gentlemen's agreements or gentlewoman's agreements about where the boundary is. In a lot of cases, the people who shook hands are not around, and nor did they leave detailed documentation about what those agreements were. So this is an attempt to just update and clarify that. Now, we have been and are running into trouble with folks attempting to form special districts and attempting to define the boundary of their district using the boundary of our county, and they're having trouble doing that. And so this would solve that problem, amongst others.
Madam Chair, and to add to this, I believe, Roger, you want to show on the map what the dispute's about. I should emphasize that this, I'm sorry, I'm Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Council representing Linn County. As Roger's indicated, to change this boundary, you need to change the statute, and that's why we're here. The middle of the river is no longer as it was 150 years ago. There are property owners who are now on the Linn side of the river, and these property owners, you will hear from them today, desire to receive the services from Linn County. And in fact, that's where we believe they are. I think it's important to note that on the technical side, that the surveyors from all five counties have gone out and surveyed the river to show where it is. This involves other counties, and the other counties are in agreement. The one county that is not in agreement is Benton County. In terms of the noise.
This was mine.
Yeah. Okay.
Were you a school teacher once?
In black and white.
Roger, go ahead and explain the parcel land that's involved here.
This is the center of the river, my first purple line. As chopped up as it may be, I assure you the boundary will not be as chopped up as that line. This is the area, really, all areas, through all the rivers and all the counties involved, this is the only area that seems to be in question or in dispute. Would be referred to as the area known as Stabas Island. This is the...
And it's not an island. It's
an peninsula.
150 years ago, it was an island or in a different place. City of Corvallis, this is Linn County. People in Linn County and most people in Benton County view the center of the river as the boundary. For Benton County to deliver services, they've got to come across the bridge, over into Linn County, down Peoria Road, which is a Linn County road, and then go access the area in question.
And the line on the outside is the former river channel, is that correct?
Correct.
So you can see how much the river has actually moved. And these landowners, and there's basically two in this area, these landowners, you know, feel that they are part of Linn County, and the river, in fact, has moved. So the boundary line in the bill is to the middle of the river.
We don't know when the river moved. We do know that it was prior to 1917. We have information that documents in 1917 the river was pretty near where it is today.
Madam Chair, I should talk about the...
Just a minute. Just a second. Question. Okay. Go ahead, please.
I think one of the issues and the legitimate issues raised by Benton County is whether there are tax dollars involved with this transfer. Those dollars, as our understanding was primarily in the machinery that's part of a small food processing center located in a food processing plant located in this area. The amount is being contested, but it's someplace between $25,000 and $35,000. So that is the amount that's involved. Lynn County has offered to pay an amount equal to 5 years of those property taxes to Benton County, but that has up to this point been rejected. Again, I want to emphasize on the technical side, this boundary has been agreed to by the surveyors. That is not to say that the Benton County surveyor has agreed to the policy of the move, just that if we're going to set this boundary to the center of the river, it has been agreed to by all the particular surveyors involved. So it's an issue because the people who live there want services. They believe that those services will be provided by Linn County. They also believe that the boundary has changed and they are in fact in Linn County. So that is what we're trying to do.
Questions? Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mark. I guess who's providing services to that area right now?
Well, that's depending on the services you're talking about. Probably Benton County and the residents would speak better to that.
Okay.
But I can tell you that there are property that technically is Linn County property on the other side of the river that this would fix that nobody's providing services to that I know of.
And so I believe there's a road in this area. It has been vacated by the county, but I think with an agreement with the property owners, I believe that there was a bridge that was some work was done or built with some federal funds some time back. But I think the property owners can best, you know, answer that in terms of their view of the services being provided, adequacy, and who's providing them.
Any other questions?
I have one more.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. If the river changes back because of a catastrophic flood, will you give the land back?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Atkinson, we believe because there are now dams along the river that you're not going to see any massive change in this area. There are provisions, however, in the bill that allows the surveyors of the counties affected by a future change to come back and to try to redraw that line. So we've made provisions in the bill if that should occur. We believe because, again, of the existence of the dams and the flood control that you're not going to see those kinds of massive shifts that we received prior to apparently 1917.
Senator Atkinson, to be clear, the answer to your question is yes. We believe it's difficult to provide adequate services to folks who, in essence, are on the wrong side of the river from our county.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I may have missed this. I apologize. Is the land under consideration all of one zoning type?
No, it's not all. It all is EFU, I believe, except in the example of Staubach Island, where there's a quarry, and where the chambers are running a small food processing plant. I couldn't tell you what the specific zoning of that property is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So have there been any attempts to rezone that recently?
Not to the best of my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks. You'll stick around if we have some more questions, would you please? Next, we have Carla Chambers, Staubach Island Farms.
Madam Chair, Eric Lindauer, I'm sneaking in here. I missed the sign up.
Okay. If Carla's willing to share the podium with you, we're happy to have you. Hi, Carla.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Lindauer. I'm here with Carla Chambers, and I'm, although our firm has a privilege of representing Staubach Island Farms, our relationship goes back to the days when we served on the State Board of Agriculture. About 10 years ago, we made frequent trips to Staubach Farm, and on many occasions I asked Carla, who's taking care of this road that comes in from the highway and into their farm? And she said, really no one's taking care of it because it's Linn County's responsibility and we can't get anybody over there. And it just befuddled her, Benton County's responsibility. And
but
it just...
You want you to get it right if you're going to...
Right, right. No, it was Benton County's responsibility. And I said, you know, it just doesn't make sense that you come across Linn County to get to your property and yet Benton County is maintaining a road. And she explained that they had to bring a road grader through this city of Corvallis across the bridge into Linn County and then back into Benton County to grade the road, and as a result, the road didn't get graded. This really cleans up a long-standing confusion in this area as between Linn and Benton County. The river should be the natural dividing line, and this bill brings that about. And I think Carla, as the owner of Staubach Island Farms, is better able than I to articulate the concerns that they have. But I know that this has been a long-standing problem. I remember it from years past, and hopefully this bill will clarify it.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions, Mr. Lander? Carla?
Well, thank you for your time. My name is Carla Chambers, and my husband Bill and I do own Staubach Island Farms. There are two residents that live on Staubach Island, my father, Carl von Borstel, and my husband Bill and I and our four children. And there are two businesses on Staubach Island, Morris Brothers and Staubach Island Farms. 100% of the businesses and 100% of the residents would like to be in Linn County. If this bill passes, both of those businesses will still own and operate farms and businesses in three counties or more in this state. I've served on the governor's transition team. I think we're all looking for ways to make government more efficient. And this, to me, is a bill that goes to the heart of that matter. Being out on this island for 18 years, we've had very poor service. Anytime you've got a case where the boundary is something other than what people think it is, then you have everybody confused. I'm still going to pay my taxes. My tax rate won't change. But it takes a lot of education to everybody when there are so many entities we deal with when they're confused about what county you're in. And I'll give you a couple examples. You know, the road grader for 18 years being out there, it's been very difficult for those people to provide service to Stallbush Island. They have to come through downtown Corvallis, as Roger said, across the Willamette River, back into Linn County, and then back into Benton County. That's highly inefficient, and at the end of the day, you get very poor service. One day when one of my employees broke an axle on the county road, I hit the limit, and I asked one of the Benton County commissioners to come out and drive on that road. The potholes are horrible. The county has been unable to maintain that road in an adequate manner, to the point where I've got national trucking companies that threaten not to come in onto the island and pick up 80,000-pound gross loads of frozen product because the county road is so poor. That's really not healthy for the state of Oregon. It's not healthy for my business, and it's not efficient use of government time. One night in the middle of the night, Linn County Sheriff, one of the sheriff deputies shows up. He thought he was in Linn County. He wasn't. He was in Benton County. You know, it's just basic common sense, and how do we make government operate more efficiently? As I said, at the end of the day, I'm still going to be a landowner in three counties. I'm still going to pay my taxes. There's no net revenue impact to the state of Oregon. And I think this is it's just good business, and it's good business for the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Carla. Questions? Senator Brown.
Thanks. Carla, you raised sort of the government service question that I had, and you said the Linn County Sheriff showed up thinking it was Linn County. Have you had any other involvement with your county law enforcement over the years that you've lived there, and who have you dealt with?
We call Benton County if we have an issue, because we are in Benton County. But as you know, there are 32 federal, state, and county entities that regulate my business. So when you've got state or county agencies that are confused, you spend a lot of time educating people on, what county and what where that property is. It's just confusing.
Another question, Madam Chair.
Another question, Senator Brown.
Do your children cross the river to go to school?
My children, I did a survey of our employees because I wanted to know where the majority of our children do go to schools, whether they are in Linn or in Benton County. The majority of my employees' children go to school in Linn County. Those children that do go to school in Benton County, my children go to a private school, and a large number of those children, two large families, are homeschooled, and we do have children in Benton County schools, but the majority of children from my employees that do attend public schools do go to Linn County schools.
Thank you. Other questions? No, thank you very much. Next, we have Annabelle from Benton County, and also Ray Wilson from Benton County. I did not announce your last name, as I did not want to mispronounce it.
Good afternoon. My name is Annabelle Jaramillo, Benton County Commissioner. And good afternoon. When I prepared this testimony, I somehow got it across my mind it was going to be this morning, but you'll need to make that editorial change on the written testimony. I'm here on behalf of Benton County, and I'm here today to testify against House Bill 3272-A. This bill would change portions of the boundary between Benton County and Linn County, and in our opinion, it is a bad bill for several reasons, the most compelling of which is that the current boundary has been in place for over 150 years, and there have been no compelling reasons to change it. It was set by the legislature and continues to work. I must ask, what is the problem that needs to be fixed? Linn County has stated its purpose, and I won't go through that purpose. I think that they think that it will make some changes which they think are problematic. But the bill also creates numerous other problems. Since the bill was introduced, the county surveyors of the affected counties have not had a formal meeting to discuss the following: the effects these changes may have on the respective north-south boundary lines. Surveyors will frequently vary on definitions such as due west or due south, and thus creating ambiguities. The adjoining counties should address these ambiguities jointly, or we will be back to correct them in the future. Why the arbitrary date of January 8, 2003 as a reference point for the middle of the river was made, that needs to be discussed. And also needs to be discussed the mechanisms for adjusting the boundaries when the Willamette River changes channels. The bill does not clarify where the boundary would be when the river moves in the future. And in spite of human efforts to contain it, the Willamette River continues to follow its own course and the channel changes. Simply put, when the river moves, we will have to revisit the issue. Another problem is, why were east-west boundaries not reconciled with the proposed north-south adjustments? This issue will have to be resolved. Passing a boundary bill without concurrence of the political subdivisions in question sets a precedent. Never before has a city or county in Oregon taken geography from another without mutual consent or agreement. While the statutes give authority to the legislature to set boundaries, they are not clear on the process. For example, ORS Chapter 202.040 requires that commissioners from affected counties shall be involved in discussions regarding proposals to change county boundaries. And while there has been dialogue on this particular boundary change, there has not been a true process of negotiation among equal parties. Benton County Council found no evidence that the legislature intended that the boundaries should move with the river. Rivers were used to designate boundaries in the early days as a matter of convenience and with the absence of technology. Boundaries between states no longer move with the changes in a river, and all we have to look at is the Columbia River for that. There has been no practical problem with the delivery of services to the areas of Benton County that would be affected by the boundary change. Personnel in the Benton County Sheriff's Office, the Health Department, Land-Based Services, and Road Department are all acquainted with the county boundaries. Fire and ambulance service will not change with the boundary change. In fact, all taxing districts for the properties affected would remain the same, except for Benton County government. The current boundary has been in place for over 150 years, and there have been no compelling reasons to change it. It was set by the legislature and continues to work. The Willamette River will continue to change its course over time, and I must ask again, what is the real problem that needs to be fixed with this bill? I respectfully urge you to oppose House Bill 3272A. And if I may try to respond to a couple of questions that came up during prior testimony, in response to Senator Corcoran's question regarding zoning in this area, it is zoned EFU, but there was a PAPA overlay for the quarry within the last 5 years, which changes that somewhat. In terms of services, and when we questioned the sheriff and others in Benton County if they had problems in delivering services to this area, they said no. And in fact, if a resident of Linn County, which would be a little further to the east from these properties, were to call and ask for services from the sheriff's department, they would follow up on that as well. And in terms of the road, it was a gravel road and needs to be graded frequently. And I'll let Ray respond that to a little bit more because he is with our Public Works Department. But as part of the PAPA conditions that were went into effect when the PAPA overlay was enacted for the quarry operation, the road was vacated, and it is part of the conditions of the PAPA. It was vacated, and there was an agreement that it would be maintained by Morse Brothers. And the reason for that was, is much of the heavy traffic that would occur on the road, when Morse Brothers increased their mining operation, the county would not be able to maintain it. Our road funds are very limited, and we would not be able to maintain that. Linn County does have significantly larger road fund, and that's because of the significantly larger forest receipts that they have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Can I just follow up on that? You're saying that the deal was when the zoning change happened with the transfer, Morse Brothers, that Morse Brothers agreed to maintain the road? Is that?
Co-Chair Klarno, Senator Brown. I'm going to let Mr. Wilson respond to that.
My name is Ray Wilson. I'm the county surveyor and the engineering surveying program manager for Benton County. When the application was filed, one of the conditions on the application was that the applicant vacate the road. Well, both the Chambers and Morris Brothers signed that petition to vacate that road with a condition that a easement be given from Morris Brothers to Chambers so they can gain access to their farm, which happened. Also in that, they also were required to have a maintenance agreement that where Morris Brothers would grade the road, I think it was a couple of times a year or whenever necessary, to keep that road up to good condition so the Chambers could continue their farming operation.
Thanks. Madam Chair, maybe another
Senator Brown.
A tougher question for Annabelle. I guess as I look at this map and not wanting to get into who did what and who didn't do what, just sort of common sense would dictate that we change the boundary. And maybe you want to answer that as the surveyor, but I just from a common sense standpoint, it would make sense to me to move the line. I guess I'm looking for your response of why we shouldn't take a more common sense approach.
Co-Chair Klarno, Senator Brown, and I can see what you're talking about, but if you look at other maps down the river, for example, I have a color map here, and I'll be glad to bring this up to you, where you'll see the changes in boundaries saying this is a section of river between Harrisburg and Junction City that has been really mapped very clearly in terms of all the channels. The concern is that with changing the boundary now is that there will be issues about changing the boundary again, and at this point, it hasn't really been a problem. We're still trying to find out what the problem is.
Okay.
And I'll be glad to leave this for you.
I have a question. What costs does Benton County expend in this area that we're discussing as far as maintaining any roads or other services?
Basically, on the roads, we probably only spend, you know, a couple thousand dollars a year, if that, as far as road maintenance, because, you know, we also, it's a gravel road. And we probably have a gravel road maintenance program where we get out and try to grade those roads at least once or twice a year. And as far as an expense, now that we've vacated that road, there's going to be very little expense in that area.
Have you maintained it at all in any way, shape, or form since it was vacated?
No, we have not.
How long is this road? How far?
It's probably close to a mile long, I suppose, down there.
So
the agreement was that when it was vacated that Morris Brothers was to maintain that, and the maintenance agreement is recorded with the county.
So the answer to my question of what cost does Benton County spend in maintaining roads or other services is
minimal.
Nothing?
Minimal.
Co-Chair Klarno, I don't have an estimate in terms of the costs that our emergency management agencies would spend in that area. They haven't received many calls, so I really couldn't tell you that.
I would like to know that because I think that there was former testimony about that there was one sheriff over there once in the time these people lived there that was lost. Thought they were in Linn County. So if you have other services to that area, we heard and further... testimony that there was not a huge population on this parcel of land, so I'd like to know what Benton County does spend in the way of services, et cetera. Senator Brown, you had a question?
Madam Chair, I just want to follow up in terms of who is legally responsible for the gravel road. My assumption from the fact that it was a condition of the rezoning for the quarry is that Morse Brothers is legally responsible for maintaining the road. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's just as you come across the river, there's a bridge that the county had put in several years ago, and that was about a $700,000 bridge that we'd replaced about 5 years ago. We maintain the road approximately 200 feet beyond that bridge, so just for turnaround purposes. From that point on, it's all private, and Morris Brothers does maintain that road.
Okay. Another question. I also would like to know the taxes, the revenue that's received to Benton County off this this piece of land.
Co-Chair Klarno, the taxes, both personal property taxes to cover the equipment from the farming operation and the property, is approximately $50,000 a year.
To Benton County.
to Benton County. There are other taxes to the other taxing jurisdictions in that area. And I think I have a sheet here that itemizes, though, but the taxes to Benton County are about $50,000 per year.
One operation or from operation?
From the property owners on Sawbush Island.
So $50,000 taxes to Benton County for all operations of the property we're talking about within this discussion.
Yes.
Of this piece of legislation.
Yes.
And you say there are other taxing districts?
Yes, there are. Let me look for that real quickly here, and I'll quickly itemize them. There's the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD, which would still remain a Corvallis 509J school district. There's a levy and bonds. There's a local option level levy for the district, Lynn Benton Community College, and bonds for Lynn Benton Community College.
What about fire services?
My understanding is that the rural fire services are purchased from the Corvallis Fire Department by the residents of Sawbush Island. They did not want to be included in the fire district when the lines were established, so they purchased that service directly.
From the city of Corvallis?
That's correct. That is my understanding.
Other questions? Not thank you both very much.
Well, if I could.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Co-chairs and committee members, I guess I'd like to get into the technical aspect of this boundary a little bit, because one of the fundamental things you want to do when you create a new boundary is you want to be able to go out and you want to be able to locate that boundary on the ground. It's just like your property lines around your homes. You want to know exactly where that line is. But if you read the bill the way it's written in the last paragraph of the Benton County section, it says the river refers to the middle of the Willamette River as it existed on January 8, 2003, and may be further identified using coordinates and other location information determined by the affected county surveyors. Okay, from my standpoint in our county, I don't have any information on where that middle of the river was located in January 8th of 2003. I don't know where that is. So if the river were to move, we're going to be right back here again, just like we, you know, the old description in 1859 said the middle of the river. We haven't really identified exactly where that is. So when the thing does move around, where is it? As Annabelle had mentioned, we have the five counties have never sat down and gone over this in a formal meeting to say this is where we want the boundary to be. That has never happened. There's a lot of ambiguity on this, the wording of the bill, of what does it mean in January 8, 2003. I don't have a map that shows that. If this bill were to go forward, the affected county should agree on one boundary, and a survey map should be prepared and filed in each county, and this map should be referenced in the law so we know where this boundary is. So when 50 years or 20 years, if this river starts wandering around, we'll at least know where it was at that time. Well, that hasn't happened. And I think you've all mentioned that when it moves, you know, we're going to be right back in the same boat again. We're going to be right back up here again doing the same thing. So I think before this bill ever moves, I think that needs to be clarified and needs to be pinned down. So any questions on that?
Mr. Brown?
I do. Are there other parts along the river where the county boundary does not co-align with the river boundary itself?
Yeah, I just happen to have
whatever. Shut up, Corker.
I would remind
legal term every day, Madam Chair.
I would remind the committee there's a certain decorum we want to maintain here.
Is that a Portland granola thing? Hold on.
Go ahead and go up there, then you can sit.
Senator, sorry, I'm coming up here, but could you sit there for him? She's blushing.
The red line is where the boundary, the old boundary is. The blue line, I think I'm right. The blue line is where the old boundary was. The red line is where the river is today. So as you can see, all these little oxbows where the river's cut through, it's the red of the new river, so pieces would go from bend to bend back and forth. That's not to say that couldn't happen again. You know, we say we have dams, but I know there's islands out in that river 3 years ago, and there were 4 or 5 years ago in 96 when the flood came, those islands are gone. So this river is subject to movement considerably. So that's why I say a specific boundary should be determined by some fashion before this bill moves forward.
Senator Brown.
So does the bill only apply to the establish?
No.
Applies to everything. Okay, all right.
We also, since I've got the map up here, we have some issues with the, how the north line and the south line were to intersect the new boundary.
Okay.
That's not clear in the bill as well. It gives the east to west, what does that mean? Even amongst surveyors, we have that discussion. So I think that could be cleared up.
Okay.
For the record, the map you're showing us, why don't you turn around and just show the audience, is similar to the one that's posted up here now.
Matched Senator Brown's face about 5 minutes.
Just in color.
What was that, Senator Corcoran?
I said it matched Senator Brown's face about 5 minutes ago.
It should have.
Madam Kochar, I just wanted to say this is similar to, it shows the Lynn-Benton County boundary, similar to the exhibit that we have distributed earlier. That has, it's called Exhibit 4 on the page. I'm not sure what exhibit it will be in our records.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, with all the puts and takes there, I see on your map, and we've got a similar map here, and you said there was about 50,000 in property taxes in that one area. Could you give me the acreage, total acreage change and total tax change between the two as we go forward?
I don't know if I have that either.
Senator Barr, if you give me a minute, I think I do have that here. Co-Chair Clarno, Senator Beyer, you're asking for total acreage. I can give you the total. With the change, approximately 1,236 acres would shift entirely to Lynn County. 895 acres would shift entirely to Benton County. And about, 719 acres would be split by the new county line. So there would be some property splits.
And the second part of your question was the taxes as well?
Yeah, the total taxes, tax change. You said this, that one island is roughly $50,000. Do you have a net figure?
I believe, and I'm going to take this off the top of my head, and I'll try to get you the exact amount. The shift of properties to Benton County is in the amount of about $6,000, and the $50,000 shift from Benton County to Lynn County. And if I'm not sure if I'm correct on this, if you would subtract the $6,000 from the $50,000, but I will check that out. The net change obviously would be greater in moving the boundary to Lynn County in terms of revenue.
You want to or you don't?
Mr. Wilson, are you through, Senator Beyer? Mr. Wilson, you said something in your earlier testimony. You have not sat down and discussed this. Have you approached Lynn County and they refused to discuss it with you, or what's the deal?
No. It's we talked about it in as far as a methodology and how this might work, but we've never really formally sat down and talked about it. None of the county, you know, like the Polk and the Lane, and Lynn and Benton have never really sat down as a group and discussed this as a formal meeting. So that's never transpired. It's all been kind of going back and forth. And really, I don't have any say in the matter. You know, my board of commissioners are the ones that make the policies and set those standards. I really don't have anything for input in that. And we let Lynn County know early on that we were not interested in pursuing this. So. And that was from the Board of Commissioners.
Well, it just seems like there's some time since it's come past in the House and been introduced. It's time to kind of see where we can come to some solution. Any further questions? Anyone else want to testify?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
thank you. And not a question for these witnesses.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming.
They asked the question, what is the real problem that needs to be fixed? And I guess maybe I'd ask the proponents, if they'll come forward and tell us what the problem is that they're trying to fix.
And while they're coming, Madam Chair, I want you to know that you're very lucky to have an expert in boundary questions, because I'm from Ireland.
I see.
And the northern six counties for years have been trying to figure out if they're part of England or part of Ireland. So I'd be happy to loan you free expertise on this at any time you wanted. But I would suggest sending them outside with guns.
I thought you were going to tell me you were an expert in having no boundaries.
There is that too, Madam Chair. Thank you so much.
So much for decorum.
Okay. Sorry about that. Get myself back here. Sorry about that. We have worked too hard lately. We're getting a little loony. Mr. Nyquist and Mr. Nelson, apologize for the lack of decorum here today. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, my name is Mark Nelson, representing Linn County. I think Benton County has posed a very good question, and what problem are we trying to solve? And I think nothing points it out better than the map that Senator Brown has put up. This river has moved. The statute says it's to the middle of the river. We have property owners who believe they have not received services, and that's not a reason unto itself. There are plenty of people throughout the state who believe they don't have received services.
I live on the east side of the Willamette River in Portland, so...
But the point being is that and it's the most fundamental part of this thing. No one has said that this river has not moved. No one has said that the property line in the statute does not say to the middle of the river. We are simply trying to adjust this property line. The reference has been made to the property line as established in January 8, 2003. Lynn County may want to comment on this, but my understanding is the surveyors from all counties, and I emphasize all counties, participated in the methodology that was used to address this. There are GPS markings for the center of this river, and I think the surveyor from Benton County said, I think his emphasis was it needed to be formally filed within every county, and I think that is correct. But all the surveyors participated, five county surveyors in that entire map that you saw. So the issue is, no one has said that center of the river is not there. It is marked by GPS. It was a consensus that they would choose it as of January 8th, and we think that's been done. Finally, the issue about the level of discussion, I think Senator Carnell brought this up. In your packets, you will have a listing of the amount of times in which this issue has been brought up. Since the House, the Linn County did go to Benton County and make an offer to try to solve this thing as it relates to replacing lost revenue, which I cited in my testimony. Was there a, quote, formal, and I think that was the Linn County Surveyor's, or Benton County Surveyor's emphasis, a formal meeting? No. There have been many, many meetings to discuss this issue, and we just simply have not arrived. Finally, the middle of the river should be the boundary, and I think the map is the most potent evidence of what needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Anything further, Senator Beyer? Mr. Nyquist, do you have anything further?
If I might, Madam Co-Chair, in your packet specifically, there have been formal meetings. Exhibit 3A would be the transcript for a meeting I had with Marion County on September 5th, 2002, in which they agreed to go forward with this legislation. Exhibit 4A would be the minutes from an October meeting I had with Lane County, in which we formally discussed this issue and agreed to go forward. In your packet, Exhibit 5 is a minutes from a meeting with Benton County on September 10th, which I brought forward the issue as well. And Exhibit 5A is Benton County's November 5th, 2002 meetings, in which they concluded that they weren't interested in participating. So what you have is a number of counties agreeing to go forward to attempt to solve a problem, and one county not being interested, proposing to stop the whole thing. And I don't I don't believe that's the practical way to approach this.
Thank you, Mr. Nyquist. Any further questions? Not. Thank you, gentlemen, both very much. Anyone that did not receive an opportunity to testify on this issue and get signed up? If not, close the public hearing on House Bill 32 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3613. Mr. Stembridge.
House Bill 3613 requires the Oregon Investment Council invest in emerging businesses in Oregon. You have -2 amendments that make several changes to the bill that passed in the House.
Representative Greenlit, is he here now?
Yes, he's here.
There you are.
And Chair, it's like Mr. QTR is trying to as well. He has a
please do.
Commitment in Portland.
Okay.
Hopefully it lives on the west side of the river.
And I believe Senator Starr will be down in a bit to join
Senator
us
Starr
as well.
Senator Starr says he'll be down in a bit.
We called Senator Starr's office, so we understand he may have had another commitment, may not be here.
If he gets here, we'll have him take a seat. 3613. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick, representing House District 33, Northwest Portland, west to North Plains, and I'm very happy to be here to bring you introduce House Bill 3613 on behalf of the Joint Bipartisan Growth Caucus. I have some written testimony, which was taken from my floor speech on this bill, and it suggests as we think about this, we have four basic questions to ask: is what 3613 recommending, is it a prudent thing to do? Is it profitable for Oregon investment funds? Is it a politically appropriate thing? And ultimately, will it lead to more jobs in Portland? We're proposing a very simple matter in House Bill 3613, although we'll hear a lot about it. It's particularly the question of asking the Oregon Investment Council to invest a relatively modest proportion of the funds under investment control in the future of the state of Oregon. A group like the Oregon Investment Council has two primary functions. One is to guard the resources and assure the safety of the resources under investment, and the second is to maximize return on that investment. And that combinations of things is something that investment programs have learned how to do fairly well, although some years they've been better at that combination than other years. Basically, the safest investments are investments that lead to relatively lower potential yield, and those investments that lead to relatively higher yield are the ones that are somewhat more risky. So programs like the Oregon Investment Council, or those of us that prudently manage 401ks or IRAs or foundations like the one I sit on the investment committee of in Portland, create something called an asset allocation model to do that. And that asset allocation model divides the funds under investment into a set of different investment categories. One of the investment categories in the Oregon Investment Council is alternative equity investments, and the asset allocation model for OIC provides a maximum of up to 13% of the total assets under investment in OIC to be invested in this alternative equity investment category, which includes to a large part venture capital investments. What House Bill 3613 does quite simply is it asks the Investment Council to invest a relatively small proportion of that asset category in Oregon startup companies, providing funds to match 50-50 with other venture capitalists to bring venture capital to Oregon. And you'll hear from several witnesses who are going to tell you how important that is. But the fact is, what we're talking about is the investment of, oh, perhaps from 100 to 400 million eventually out of the $45 billion investment in the Oregon Investment Council. Is this a prudent thing to do? Well, the first thing that we need to know is that sometimes very prudent investments turn out to be wrong. I mean, we've made very prudent investments in organizations, in equities and bonds of organizations like WorldCom, for example, because they were investment grade investments, and we made them properly, and we ended up losing a great deal of money. We made investments very early on in the Oregon Investment Council in what's known as junk bonds, although they have another name now. They're called high yield investments, and there were many people that questioned the prudence of that investment, but the fact is that investment turned out very good, and it fueled a lot of the growth of the Oregon Investment Council. OIC's investments lost about 6% in 2001 and another 5% in 2002, proving that very prudent investments sometimes don't do well. And in fact, those outcomes were very good outcomes compared to lots of other investments over that same period. But the real question now is, and it's a question that you'll hear raised by our treasurer, and that's whether we, the legislature, have a proper authority to bring social policy and public policy into the discussions about how OIC invests its funds. And that's, I think, a very critical question for you to face. I think I do need to point out, as I do in my testimony, that OIC was created by legislative action, that OIC was allowed to invest in stocks due to legislative action, that OIC has been directed to limit its equity investment due to legislative action, and that in the past we've required that OIC divest itself from South African investments because of social policy. None of these things hurt the ability of the OIC to make prudent investments. The OIC, if you read the annual report of the Oregon State Treasurer, you'll find out that the Oregon Investment Council proudly invests in what it calls Oregon companies. Even though there's no requirement to do so, and the Oregon investment includes investing in Quest Communications, Albertsons, Safeway, United Parcel, Wells Fargo, and Walmart, all of which provide services in Oregon, but none of which are going to develop the new family wage jobs we need to prevent the next economic downturn in this state. The proposal 3613 brings to the Oregon Investment Council, and there is a lot of flexibility about how the council can react to that, is likely to create a great many jobs. Since Senator Starr's might not be here today, I'd like to quote from his House testimony, where he said, the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development's 2002 report suggested that an Oregon seed fund with just $20 million in capital helped over a 7 to 10 year period 50 Oregon companies and created over 3,000 jobs, realized revenues of nearly $800 million, and leveraged over $570 million of additional investments. Senator Starr calculated in that testimony that if these numbers could be extrapolated over the minimum amount of funds we're proposing OIC invest in Oregon, that 30,000 new jobs could be created by passing this bill, that $8 billion in revenue can be created by passing this bill, and that $5 billion in new money invested in Oregon can be created by passing this bill. We've had some conflict from the public employee unions who were worried about the change in definition of what prudent investing is and who were worried about forcing the OIC into investments that were not prudent. You have in front of you -2 amendments. Those -2 amendments have been worked out with the unions and with others, and create the safety valve so that no imprudent investments will be forced by the implementation of House Bill 3613.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Can you tell me which unions have and which unions haven't worked that out? Because it's not all the unions, my understanding.
My understanding is there are no unions that are currently opposing it if the -2 amendments are added.
Madam Chair, another question.
Senator Corcoran.
I saw, I think, only 3 public sector unions that said that they would put their names to it.
Well, I think you'll get testimony today from some of the public sector unions. All I can repeat again is there are, to my knowledge, no public sector unions that will be opposing the bill if the -2 amendments are included in it.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have another question.
And that ends my testimony, and I'm very happy to answer
okay.
questions.
My other question, Representative Greenlick, is I don't understand why we need this when we have the Oregon Growth Account.
There isn't any money in the Oregon Growth Account. We put that in the Oregon Growth Account and then essentially eliminated the funds. So if we're going to move towards preventing the same kind of economic environment in the future, we need to get to work putting funds very quickly into this into venture capital in Oregon. We had remarkable growth during the 90s, although that wasn't spread out through the state, but we did have remarkable growth, and that's stopped because the ability to fund new ideas and new companies has become very difficult.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So another issue that's been raised is the differentiating between state-managed funds versus state-owned funds. So in your proposal, would it impact the PERS fund, obviously, which is state and local government, the Common School Fund, and the Oregon Short-Term Fund, which includes billions of local government monies. I'm not very comfortable with the idea that we would be instructing the OIC how to invest local government monies.
Well, right now the OIC has decided to invest, and it may differ from sub-account to sub-account, but has decided to use the asset allocation model to guide the investment decisions across these funds. Those decisions right now include a relatively important proportion of investments in these exact kind of companies. We're not directing them to invest different kinds of investments. All we're directing them in this bill, and we're not even directing them, we're pointing them at looking first at Oregon companies when it decides to invest money in venture capital. So we're not creating a new category of investment that will affect these funds. They've decided to invest in this kind of investment. All we're asking is that when they use funds for these purposes, in each of these entities will be greatly helped by a stronger Oregon economy. We're asking them to look to Oregon first when they begin to make these kind of investments. It seems to me it's good public policy to do that, and it in no way risks these funds any more than the decision has already been made to risk them in these kind of investments.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Keith Barnes. I'm the retired chairman and chief executive officer of a company called Integrated Measurement Systems. This was an Oregon venture startup company. We were funded by Shaw Venture Partners, Mayfield Fund out of California, Oak Investment, Adler, and Rosewood, which was Hunt Money. We were Oregon's 40th largest public company. We were acquired in 2001 by a California company, and I retired a year after that. The period in time which we received our venture funding was the 83 through 1987 period. We received about $12 million in venture funding and eventually returned to the shareholders about $200 million. So it was a pretty good investment for our company. During that same period, there were several other companies that were funded through local venture capital firms and out-of-state firms. Companies like Mentor Graphics, InFocus Systems, Planar, and Sequent Computer. Now, there are many other companies that were funded by VC firms during that period as well, but I just want to try to put in perspective how much money went into VC at that point in time, 83 through 87, and how much has been going into VC, you know, in the next couple of years. So from 83 through 87, there was about $500 million invested in venture capital in the state of Oregon. From 1987 through 1992, 93, there was about $100 million invested. So it dropped off very, very rapidly during that period, and very few startups occurred during that time frame. It increased during the 90s, and it's dropped off again. And we can get you specific numbers, but it's dropped off pretty precipitously. Oregon's in tough shape. Everybody knows that we've got an 8% unemployment rate. Revenues are down. We're not attracting new businesses. It's really a tough time out there. One of the ways to turn that around is to invest in growth-oriented small companies. Those are the companies that typically end up hiring the fastest number of employees or the largest number of employees during their growth periods. I am currently on a company which is a venture startup company by the name of Clarity Visual Systems. This is a company that's taken funding from outside the state and also from angel investors inside the state. It's doing quite well. We are hoping to have a very good return for the investors from that account. I'm also on the Oregon Growth account. And I would agree with Representative Greenlick that the OGA funds have been taken because of the budget problems in the recent couple of months. So there are no funds currently available to put into venture capital. That's one of the reasons why this bill is before you. So from our standpoint, we see this as being a very important bill. Some additional background I have, I was the chairman of the American Electronics Association in Oregon in the 93-94 period when the venture capital had dropped off to about $100 million. And during that period, there were quite a few very good ventures that came to me when I was chairing that because they couldn't find funding in the state. A lot of those companies either left the state or went out of business. And these were good people that came from very good backgrounds, mostly technology people, because that's what we dealt in. And so the point is that, you know, there needs to be additional venture capital in the state to be able to help those companies that can support additional growth in the community. I would encourage the legislature to support the funding of this bill, to advance it to the Senate floor. I think that if for any reason this bill is defeated, we ought to look for alternatives to it, because the point is we have to find additional capital for small businesses to start in the state so that we can not only get a good return, which I think you can get from venture capital investments, but also to make sure that we can get the kind of high pay jobs that come with those knowledge-based workers. I'm an optimist. I believe that we can actually make a difference. I believe that by advancing this bill and finding sources of capital for these small businesses, we can turn the situation around in Oregon, generate additional revenues, and start to do the kinds of things that are required to get the education system and the business climate and the unemployment at the right place. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks. We appreciate you being here today. Next up on the list, Les Fahey, Dennis McEnany, and Wayne Embry. On deck, Jim Johnson, Harvey Matthews, and in the hole, Chuck Bennett and Randall Edwards.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair. My name's Les Fahey, and my company is Fahey Ventures. My background, I am in support of the bill. My background was I spent 23 years at KPMG, an international accounting firm here in town, in Portland, working with the high technology industry, and basically was involved at the very beginning of the growth there. I worked with a number of very successful high technology companies, including Pixelworks, Planar Systems, Inc., Digimark, etc. And one of the things that is true is that most of the prominent high technology companies that we can think of were funded initially through venture capital. The ultimate results are a lot of these companies grew to be very successful public companies with significant market capitalizations and employing a large number of people. I'm actually now, since I retired from KPMG, working with a handful of early-stage companies trying to help them in the growth stages. And the current climate that we're in is an extremely difficult climate for helping companies get funded. And if it continues, we're not going to have the continued get back to a very vibrant economy anytime soon. Currently, the state really only has effectively two significant venture capital funds here, and if you're an early-stage company, very quickly rotate through those, it's quite likely, and you need to then start talking to funds out-of-state. And the out-of-state funds tend to want to invest close to home, and so it can be very difficult for an early-stage company to gain capital now. I personally believe that this is a great time for companies to get started because the cost of employees, space, etc., is fairly inexpensive, but it's also a time when venture capital is being very conservative and cautious to invest. There's a strong need to bring a couple more local venture funds here because at the early stages, funds do like to invest close to home, and then the out-of-state funds where there's quite a bit of capital, if there's a lead investor locally, we'll then tend to follow that investment. I'm actually working with, I mentioned earlier, a handful of companies that I'm trying to help fund, and three of them are led by CEOs that had built public companies in the past. And when you look at the quality of those teams, you would think that they ought to be able to raise capital fairly easily, and they might if they're in California. But here it's been a real tough challenge. And in fact, they've had, in several cases, have been told by California venture funds that if they'd relocate the business down there, that they would most likely be funded relatively quickly. So that's not a good answer for Oregon. We'd like to keep these companies here, but it is challenging to some of these companies to try to build and grow the companies here. I personally believe the state needs about 2 to 3 more local venture funds, and part of the reason for that is just not only the need for more capital, but a diversity of interest by venture funds, I think, is important. Different sizes, different areas of interest, software, hardware, whatever. Secondly, I think that 2 to 3 more funds, the amount of capital that this bill suggests, would just meet that requirement. And then I also think that that's an amount of funding that would not create an overly hot environment here where maybe the deals would get overpriced. And in essence, I do believe that would result in a good investment to PERS, and where companies would get funded, be able to grow and be successful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next, and I'm going to have to ask you to shorten your testimony. We have two other bills left and a number of people left to testify, so thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Wayne Embry. I'm the managing partner of Cascadia Partners in Portland, Oregon. We've been a seed stage venture capital fund here for 17 years. From 1986 to 1999, our firm co-managed the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Fund, a lottery-funded vehicle created by the 85 Assembly. to address this issue 20 years ago when the last serious market downturn that we had. That fund received about $12.3 million of $20.5 million that was allocated by four separate legislative assemblies. With that money, however, we created the companies that are on page two of my handout. And with those funds, we generated returns which were on par with top-tier venture capital funds of the same vintage as the Resource and Technology Development Fund. And that was with companies we could only invest in inside the state, and approximately half the companies we invested in were based on spin-outs from research institutions. I was given the charge of being the numbers guy. When you look at the performance of early-stage private equity, and one of the reasons why it's attractive to entities like the Investment Council, is that it's generated the highest rate of returns of any form of alternative investment, particularly the very early, seed and early stage. However, over the last 10 years, the money going into venture funds, buyout funds, has been going into increasingly larger funds. So at this point, 80% of all money going into private equity from organizations like the OIC are going into funds that are larger than $250 million. So consequently, what's happened is the amount of available capital, this is nationwide and it's even worse in Oregon, and if you look at the top of page five, the amount of available capital for startups has crashed during the last 8 years. And this is not part of the internet bubble bursting. This has been a systemic change in the face of the market. And then, as Les just mentioned, we're now in a position where this is actually the ideal time to be investing in startups. Historically, the bottom of down markets is the best time to invest in startup companies. And several of our best winners were companies that were founded at this time. Radisys, FEI, and Antivirals were three companies we invested in at the bottom of the market in the late 1980s, and all returned exceptional amounts of money back to the fund.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Do you see any correlation? I mean, there's a lot of us in the building wondering where the bottom is. Do you see a, I mean, where's your hope that we're on the way up?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, we actually invested in those companies on the way down in the late 80s, and so they had to survive. And indeed, none of those three companies received money from local venture capitalists. So they had to be creative and struggle, and they got money from outside sources. So they had to survive longer. We actually, you know, I'm not going to try and predict when the bottom is, but I think we're close enough to the flat end of it that I think companies that are getting funded now will actually return more capital than those companies that have been getting consistently funded over the last 5 years, hoping for an IPO market to return.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Corcoran.
But isn't this the circumstances of the past 2 years, 9/11 aside, isn't this from a world, a global sort of market perspective, a really different time than the late 80s? I mean, it just a lot of certified smart people, I'm not one of them, but there's a lot of certified smart people in this building that talk about the distinctions in this particular business cycle from the other cycles that we've had in this state.
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, you're absolutely right. There is a very different time, and I think that actually speaks to the reason for doing this. The problem with the venture funds that we have in the state right now is they're so aligned in the industries in which they're willing to invest that if a company falls outside of that, if you have a company that has a new technology in agriculture, a new technology in forest products, in water, it is highly unlikely that those companies will be able to find funding locally. But yet, the markets for those companies are growing rapidly worldwide. So I think it comes back to actually being able to have a local investment climate infrastructure that's responsive to the opportunities in a changing marketplace.
Madam Chair, so the other question, I guess, occurs to me, and you can tell by my questions that I'm very unfamiliar with this area, is what is the OIC? I would assume that the OIC has a portfolio, they have to be, I mean, whatever the prudent requirements are, that one aspect of that would be a current investment, venture capital investment. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Senator Corkin, that's true. The OIC is something we actually track. There are heavily invested in organizations that invest in large venture capital funds. The OIC is invested, as far as I know, into only two venture capital funds directly. They have a number of indirect investments through things called funds of funds. But Olympic Venture Partners and one other are the only ones that they are directly invested in the venture market. And the investments that they've made into other entities that then invest in venture are also tend to be invested in very large venture funds, very few of which, if any, are in this region.
Madam Chair, so wouldn't... I guess I'm really trying to grab a hold of this. I mean, I signed on to this bill originally because it just, you know, Buy Oregon sounded like, you know, I mean, I think we're going towards a balkanization anyway, so, you know, it wouldn't hurt to get it started this year. But I'm really struggling with the issue of the investments that we currently make in the venture capital aspect of all these investments, just in that narrow band, are made. They're reasoned decisions. I'm very concerned that this becomes a, you know, a good old boy club for Oregon folks that are in this game at the expense of the system. So I guess my question is sort of, and Representative Greenlick pointed out how well the Oregon Investment Council did vis-a-vis other folks in the same time. So I'm wondering, Do we really gain by creating some manipulation in those decisions if they're making good decisions now?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I guess one could argue, looking at the data, whether they are appropriately allocated where the highest returns are being generated. And that's a discussion to have with the Investment Council and the Chief Investment Officer. From the perspective of, does this make sense? One other data point with my own career is in 1995, we were recruited to begin a seed fund, a captive seed fund in British Columbia. The Chief Investment Officer of British Columbia was also starting five other venture capital funds at the time because of the same thing that we're seeing here. There was a shortage of capital and opportunities for resident firms. That fund was very small. It was $10 million Canadian, $7 million U.S. at the time. And to date, it's generated about $18 million U.S. in returns, which was also in the top tier for venture capital funds nationally for that time period. All I know is one can invest locally. One can make top-tier venture capital rates of return. The current policies inside the Oregon Investment Council are actually biased against Oregon funds. I guess one could argue that I'm one of the old boys because I've been doing business here, and I think the odds of us getting money from the Investment Council without this legislation or with this legislation are virtually zero. So I'm here because I think it's the best thing for the state.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Anything further? Thank you, gentlemen. He hasn't testified yet. Okay. We're about to run out of time, so I appreciate you speeding up. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. And Senators, I think I may be the only entrepreneur here today, but irrespective of this, I represent, I think, the future of some of the companies that are going to be coming to Oregon, all over Oregon, in fact. I was recently returned from a trip to Bend where I met quite a few entrepreneurs in my same position. To tell you a short story, which is that the last company I started in 1997.
I'm sorry, I need to have your name for the record.
Excuse me, Dennis McDaney, CEO of Core Policy Systems.
Thank you.
I started in 97. We raised a little over $1.6 million locally. We sold it for $28.5 million in 2000, which sounds like an entrepreneurial success, but it wasn't much of a success for Oregon because the company that acquired us was in California and the people who invested us were in Washington. So the net effect was most of the proceeds went out of state, all of the jobs eventually went out of state, and now I'm back starting a new company. And I point this out because I think Oregon faces a real crucial decision as to whether they want to be an incubator for companies or whether they want to be that place where companies can find the long-term funding to survive. And as a company, a CEO of a company, I can assure you when you get to that point where you're competing with people who have more financial resources, you will eventually seek out those same financial resources. And there's a gravitational pull that CEOs cannot resist long-term. If they can't fund their companies locally, those companies will disappear. I think in closing, what I'd like to say is that most entrepreneurs assume they're going to make their success on their own, and I think that's the way the best entrepreneurs approach business. But access to capital will dictate how large those companies get and where they're located, and I think that's what we're what I'm down here to advocate for in support of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Sorry to rush. Next, we have Jim Johnson and Harvey Matthews.
My name is Jim Johnson. I'm a retired high-tech executive and an angel investor. I'm here to in support of 3613. I think it's a prudent law, and I think that it gives Oregon a chance. That's all it does. It doesn't require an investment of any kind. It just says, give Oregon a chance. I've invested in one company that's already left the state because when they went for their B round, they couldn't find it here. The two available VCs didn't like them. There were a couple of VCs in the Bay Area that did. They said, in order for us to invest, you need to move to California. They said, we're moving. I'm right now in the middle of another company that's going through a capital round that may end up in the same place. So Oregon is a great place. It's just that we don't have enough of a network. And believe me, it is all about relationships. To think that two VCs can cover an entire state is naive because they can't even cover an entire, you know, square block because of the expertise and the relationships. You know, in other areas when those CEOs, they go to dinner with these guys, they go to the golf, you know, a court with them, they interact with them so that even when they're being told no, they're still working the relationship. So when eventually they're at a yes, you know, it's there. With an Oregon, you get your one shot, you get to fly down to Sand Hill Road, you get shoveled in, you get your 20 minutes. If you're lucky to get that, you're told no, and that's it. So this bill, in my mind, is all about giving Oregon a chance. And if we're not willing to give Oregon a chance, then who is? So there's a lot of other things I can say, but due to shortness of time, I will end it there.
Thank you. Any questions? Harvey, do you want to put your name on the record, please?
Yes, Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. We brought forth this bill with Representative Greenlick in order to solve a couple of problems, the unemployment rate and also the number of businesses exiting our state, all of which play a critical role in the funding crisis that you are currently experiencing. You may hear testimony today that this bill will adversely affect school funding. I think that's ludicrous. The amount of general fund that will be generated from successful businesses starting, growing, and employing workers in Oregon from this bill will more than compensate for any potential losses. Senator Bruce Starr was called away to business in Portland, but if I may read two sections of his testimony into the record.
Are they very long, Harvey?
No.
Okay.
They're very short. He says, the treasurer representing the Oregon Investment Council is opposing the bill, and he says that it creates a bad precedent for the legislature to direct investment practices of the OIC. And to that, Senator Starr says the OIC was created by legislative action, it was allowed to invest in stocks through legislative action, and has been directed in the past to disinvest in South African stocks by legislative action. And this bill represents yet another way the legislature can appropriately use its oversight responsibilities to achieve a positive result. So, in closing, House Bill 3613 creates jobs, it intelligently directs investments, and it is prudent. And I thank you for your support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Not. Thank you very much. Mr. Treasurer Edwards and Chuck Bennett.
Good
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. I know you're short on time. And we're submitting some testimony. It also is a floor letter I put out and some information regarding my concerns relative to this bill. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill. I do think, as the proponents are talking about, we in this building and in my office and every office should be looking at opportunities to put money to work in Oregon. Again, I think the focus of this bill and the idea behind helping Oregon is a good one. And in fact, many in this room, we've worked together in trying to find opportunities to expand startup companies in the state. For example, the Oregon Opportunity, which was a $200 million investment made by the legislature through my office. We've recently funded about half that investment in the state to start up, help expand bioscience and opportunities around biomedical research. Last session, you gave me about $15 million in helping a seed fund that will also help take technology out of our universities. Again, another area which we need to continue to expand in the state. I think that what I'm concerned about in this bill is that we are starting down a road of setting a precedent about how specifically we manage other people's monies, and I think that's something I want to underscore again. It really begins to, in my mind, conflict with the prudent investor standards of risk that have guided the Oregon Investment Council in managing a number of funds which belong to other people. I gave you a list attached in your information of a variety of funds that are other funds. That is things like the pension fund, the common school fund, the safe fund, a variety of funds which have a specific beneficiary attached to it, in which we, my office, the Treasury, the Oregon Investment Council, set out policy to manage and invest to meet objectives set out in helping these beneficiaries in each of these funds. Again, Common School Fund is for the benefit of children of the state currently and in the future. The PERS Fund is for the beneficiaries of the PERS system. Again, these are not state-owned monies. These are not these like tax dollars or lottery money. These are used for a variety of other public purposes. Each fund, as I indicated, have a specific purpose in them. It was indicated earlier in testimony about where we do put money to work in the state. The state, and through my office, we have put $600 million into a variety of investments that have an impact on Oregon. Our largest domestic equity manager is located in Portland. We do use the private sector to put money to work in the state. As was again indicated in testimony, we do put money to work in private equity, in venture capital, a few firms which are located in Oregon. And again, this was all done using the private market to do that. And I want to also underscore that the Oregon Investment Council acknowledges that there are opportunities in the state, and we have a policy that does suggest, and I'll quote it, the Oregon Investment Council recognizes that excellent investment opportunities may exist in Oregon and actively considers investments within the state. So we are not blind to opportunities in Oregon, and in fact, I would argue we do put money to work in the state using the market.
Excuse me, Mr. Treasurer. Mm-hmm. Senator Brown has a question.
I actually have a couple of questions. I know that in the 80s we directed the OIC to divest the South African stocks, and I guess if we can do that then, why can't we do this now? And then my other question is, how would you make the distinction in terms of the other states that have programs to invest in state funds from Oregon? I assume they have the same general legal fiduciary requirements.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. Co-chair, let me say that in the case of South Africa, that was the one time that the legislature directed the Oregon Investment Council to divest from investments of companies that had business in South Africa. That is the only time that, for public policy purposes, a mandate was placed on how we manage money. What I want to distinguish, this bill specifically would tell us what kind of investments we make. It's a different mandate, and it was also highlighted earlier that you do create law around how we manage money, but I would suggest it's very limited in how you allow us. I mean, there are very, very few restrictions in how we manage that money. We are free to use the marketplace to make investments, whether it's in state, out of state. We use the marketplace to achieve returns for the different beneficiaries. And I was going to continue on with my testimony. What you, the legislature, recognized was that there was an opportunity, as outlined in this bill, for emerging growth businesses in Oregon. And a few years ago, you created the Oregon Growth Account, which was a fund funded by a lottery in which we would put money into emerging growth businesses in the state. In fact, this bill lifted the mandate of emerging growth businesses and put it on top of the Oregon Investment Council. The legislature went through this debate and decided that because it had an Oregon mandate, that it would be excluded from the fiduciary laws that govern on the prudent investment standards that govern us, in us being the Treasury, myself, and Investment Council, and managing these other funds which have specific purposes outside of a public policy purpose, which the Oregon Growth Account really dictated. So again, in the Oregon Growth Account, we have put to work $20 million that has leveraged other federal money, exceeding $100 million. So we are putting money to work in emerging growth businesses. And I think this is where I think the debate really is how can we most appropriately utilize the Oregon Growth Account? I have a private sector board that oversees finding partnerships to put money in, so we share the risk. In fact, a couple of people who testified today sit on that board, that we do need to look at utilizing this tool to making sure that we can put money to work in Oregon. And one of the concerns that I have, and I think that's driven partly by some of the support by my board members, is that in the rebalancing in the sixth special session, if you will, approximately $5 million was taken out of the Oregon Growth Account. And as a result, we do not have very much money to go out and make an investment. In fact, we would be hard-pressed to put an investment in Oregon this year. So I think one of the concerns that I have is making sure that we, as a state, are long-term investors and believe in what the policy is behind this bill, are committed to using the appropriate monies to find emerging growth businesses and making that a reality. In conclusion, I recognize there is a problem, and I think that's been articulated. I want to work with the proponents of this bill. I've talked to some. In fact, I submitted an email from one of the proponents, Scott Gibson, about how the Oregon Investment Council, we are looking at expanding our venture capital, which is a natural reflection of what we need to do anyway. And I believe, working with the chair, we can continue to find opportunities where we would find top-tier managers that could have a potential reach in the state of Oregon. I also want to work with you to find ways to figure out how we can better use the Oregon Growth Account to meet the objectives that are spelled out in the statute today and in this bill. One suggestion, it has been suggested that we don't have much money coming in. What I would suggest is we get $5 million each year, $10 million per biennium of lottery money, roughly. These are rough figures to invest in this mandate. One of the things I would like to work with you on is there some way that we could front-load more of that money up front, in which case we could make an investment this biennium, because so that we would diversify our investments over this year and the next year. Currently, I can't do that given the way the law is constructed. And again, I'm here to be a facilitator. I think the idea is that we have opportunities in the state. We want to find those opportunities. Where it's appropriate, we will use the marketplace. And again, we have an opportunity through the Oregon Growth Account to meet the exact mandate that's being put on us here. If we could front load the Oregon Growth Account, I mean, we're talking the potential over the next two biennials. There's a limit by 06 to have $100 million put out. If we could front load some of the Oregon Growth Account money, we could actually have $80 million in play. My feeling is, again, I'll conclude that
we want to help find a solution to in the Oregon situation. There's no question Oregon's struggling, but let's be make sure that we find the right funds to do it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Bob Muir with the Attorney General's office is here. He submitted a letter regarding sort of the concerns he saw from a legal point of view relative to the bill. And Ron Schmitz, who's my chief investment officer, who also could speak and answer any questions regarding kind of the specifics of how we invest money in the state of Oregon.
We do have some questions. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Randall, I guess I'm looking at the dash twos. I don't know if your testimony was speaking to the bill or to the dash twos, but I'm looking at the dash two amendment. And it seems to me that on page two of the dash twos, when you get to the end of the new language, it says growth businesses in Oregon, comma, unless under circumstances it is not prudent to do so. That appears to me it still leaves all the discretion to the investment council as to whether or not it is prudent to do so. So I'm curious to know if your comments applied to the bill as we had it or the dash two amendments.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, my comments were to the bill as written. We have not had a chance to really analyze the dash twos, and I do think, though, that there are still, just a glancing at this, problems with the dash twos. Again, it does change a standard of investment under 293.726. It does mandate to look first at Oregon opportunities for diversification. Again, that would be a brand new mandate in how we look at managing a variety of funds, unprecedented. Again, the shall and may, again, sets up a situation where we have at least $100 million, and it presumes that there's $100 million worth of investment that we can go put to work immediately within, as the dash twos also put a timeline by, I think it's 06, that we would have that done. I think the attempt here is to try to fit this in a prudent standard, which not having had much time and nor is Bob Muir to look at it, I think it still raises many flags about how we would manage this money.
Another question, Senator Brent Meyer.
I think it is important to recognize that the shells are changed to mays in the dash twos. But another question, I guess, on a different issue would be, does the past history with PAMCOR and what happened there with the investment council have anything to do with your concerns now?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, no. I mean, I think that's a great example of, again, and it was testified earlier, investing is risky. And you got to make sure you follow a process where you do a lot of due diligence, and even then you can find investments that go south for a variety of reasons. That investment, regrettably, should never have been made. Even though it was made in Oregon, I guess that's even more painful. It could have happened somewhere else. So my point is, no, that doesn't influence why or why not we look in the state. I restate, we do look in Oregon. And in fact, you've given me a mandate to look in Oregon through the Oregon Growth Account as chair of that board.
Further questions? Any other questions? Not thank you, Mr. Treasurer, and thank you for your staff that came along, and appreciate you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I just want to, we had an earlier discussion about union support for this, and I just guess that in checking with a couple of the unions, the unions are not fine with this. They are neutral.
Okay.
That's a much different take, in my view. So I just want to get that on the record.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3613 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3264A. And Charlie Stone, ODF, and Richard Whitman, DOJ.
Madam Co-Chair, HB 3264A eliminates the requirement in the Oregon Forest Practices Act that the state forester approve forestry operation plans.
Before you begin, I know a lot of people have been waiting a couple hours, and I'll just say on deck will be Ray Wilkinson and then Mary from the Pacific Rivers Council and Patty Goldman from Earth Justice, and then I'll let you know next because we and Stephen Cafori.
Okay.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester with the Department of Forestry. House Bill 3264 was initiated as a result of a lawsuit in federal court alleging that State Forester is violating the Endangered Species Act. But I'd like to contend that this bill would be good policy with or without the lawsuit. And it responds to some concerns that I think the department has faced over time about the relationship within the Forest Practices Act and the nature of approvals and permits and that type of language. The Forest Practices Act in its original form back in the 70s had no such permitting implications. An operator would file a notification of their intent to operate, and then they follow the rules. And if they violated the rules, then enforcement action would be taken.
Madam Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
Who would provide the enforcement action?
The Department of Forestry. We have forest practices foresters throughout the state that inspect those operations and evaluate them in terms of compliance. And there are civil penalty mechanisms now. That came in 1987. There's criminal prosecution. There are repair orders. So there's a variety of means to enforce the law.
Madam Chair?
Senator Corcoran?
So that would pretty much make them the regulators then of the Oregon Forest Practices Act?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Please proceed.
In about 1983, it was the first time that the Board of Forestry's administrative rules contemplated the use of written plans, and that was when we were dealing with landslides for the first time as a major element within the forest practices rules. The intent of a written plan and the approval by the state forester was to be able to carry on a technical discussion between the department and the operator and the landowner to make sure that they had a viable plan to comply with the law in areas where you really couldn't write very specific rules because of the emerging nature of the science and the knowledge base within the industry. It wasn't until 1987 that the legislature then applied written plans as a mandatory matter in statute for certain types of operations, and even then it's still a subset of the overall operations. But we contend that the viewpoint was always that written plans were to have a discussion to make sure that the operators and landowners had an adequate understanding of what they were about to embark on, and that it was an opportunity to see if they were going to comply, not that the state forester is authorizing or denying the ability to operate. And that's already pretty much provided by land use planning. The lands are zoned as forest lands for forest uses, and it was never the intent, we believe, and we don't believe it is the intent today of the legislature to put the state forester in the role of saying yes, you may, or no, you may not operate, but rather to evaluate is your plan adequate, will it comply with the rules, and then if you do comply with the rules, great. If you don't, then we come out and we take enforcement action. This all comes back to the lawsuit then. The state forester is being alleged to violate the ESA by the approval action, approving forest operations that might somehow in down the stream and down the course of time result in a take of coho salmon. We believe that this bill, as it's constructed and with amendments that we're proposing, I believe through Senator Brown's a note, and I guess those amendments haven't been completed as yet, but through that, through the bill and through the amendments, to clarify in the law that the state forester does not approve operations. The state forester reviews them, may comment back to the operator as to whether they'll comply with the rules, and then it's up to the operator to conduct the operation appropriately with that advice, and if they violate those rules, to be brought up short, and we can still stop operations. We can take all the actions that I talked about. In terms of the proposed amendments, let me first say that as proposed, the bill would still maintain all the substantive protection measures that are in the Board of Forestry's rules and within the statutes. It still retains the written plans as a mechanism. The operators and landowners still have to submit written plans for review, but not for approval by the state forester, and we can comment back so that they know where their plans stand. It retains all the enforcement mechanisms that are in the rules, and it retains the public comment capability. When somebody submits a notification or a written plan, the public can comment on that operation. In the chance that the state foresters miss something or the application of that, if the public points out something valid in terms of the likelihood of a violation, we can still take action on that, and there's still a mechanism to have a double or a second look at that by requesting a hearing by the Board of Forestry in certain circumstances. So we believe that the Forest Practices Act is not weakened by this action. The same mechanisms are at play. The amendments that...
Senator Corcoran?
So, under current situations, the notification by a timber cutter cannot be dismissed by the state forester. He can't prevent it.
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, in there are different types of operations. Currently, some operations within 100 feet of fish-bearing streams, within 300 feet of certain resource sites such as wetlands or eagle nest sites, the operator and landowner have to submit a written plan, and they cannot operate until that plan's been approved. But the basis is that plan in compliance with the rules? Does it demonstrate the ability to carry out the operation lawfully? There are other operations away from streams, not involving special sites, where the operator simply notifies the state forester and after a 15-day waiting period can commence the operation.
And under those conditions, Madam Chair, under those conditions, then in no way, shape, or form can the state forestry department stop that operation?
Not unless they violate the rules, sir.
And if they violated the rules, they could stop the operation.
In that case, Senator Corcoran, if they violate the rules, then the state forester issues a notice of violation. If they orders them to cease further violation, and can order repairs of the operation. If they don't cease the violation, then the state forester has the authority to issue an order to stop the operation until they correct the situation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So in this situation of the lawsuit, an environmental group sues the state forester for failure to sustain a federal ESA responsibility. Is that correct?
That's the theory of the case, yes.
Okay. All right.
I'm really struggling with this. The fact that it's before a case is alive before the court makes it very, very uncomfortable. And the notion that, Madam Chair, that you either are or you aren't a regulator is kind of the way I'm looking at this. I just can't say... It's hard for me to get to your regulator except for we don't want to be sued. You know, in this particular thing, I'm really struggling with this.
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think maybe the key with regard to the lawsuit is the state forester is a regulator of the Forest Practices Act, but you've never given us authority or budget or direction to administer the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Well, then, let me ask. That raises a question, Madam
Senator
Corcoran.
Then
I'll
Corcoran.
Shut up for the afternoon. Thank you. So are you saying that in the history of forestry oversight under the Forest Practices Act, you have never stopped an operation because of concerns of violations of federal law?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
On private land. Yeah, I mean, the state forester on state lands has to operate as a landowner and comply with federal laws, but in terms of administering the Forest Practices Act, I believe that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, were you finished, or did we
not
just...
Not quite.
Please go ahead.
Speaking to the proposed amendments, and just in general terms, I think the amendments that we propose try to clarify further elements in the Forest Practices Act that deal with language that puts the state forester in the position of approving or disapproving operations, so we try to get all those cleared up. It attempts to make better sense out of the appeal provisions that currently exist with regard to that approval of written plans while still giving the public an ability to be heard by the Board of Forestry if they don't agree with the state forester's remarks or comments back to the operator. It directs the Board of Forestry to amend the forest practice rules with regard to the language, written plans, and prior approvals that that are throughout the rules currently following the statutes. And it clarifies when the when this bill would become effective and adds an emergency clause. We understand that in trying to prepare the amendments to this point, the last page was lost, and the emergency clause and some of that effective language was not put into the effort yet, so we'd like to work back with the legislative council and make sure that that all gets built into the amendments. I guess my last point is that should this bill pass, as we hope it will, it may moot out the lawsuit, and right now we're concerned about several hundred thousand dollars in litigation costs to the state as a an element. And I've already made the other point with regard to the Endangered Species Act, and that you've not directed us to do that, and that seems to be the outcome of the lawsuit if the state forest is held responsible for taking into account whether the operation would or would not violate the Endangered Species Act. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
A couple of questions. One of the complaints about this bill is that there was inadequate notice and opportunity to be heard on the House side, and I was just curious if you're familiar with the length of the hearing and the amount of notice that was given to both sides when this was scheduled for a hearing in the House.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I did not attend the hearing in the House side. Assistant State Forester Ted Lawrenson did. There was a hearing. Our folks appeared and testified. I don't recall what the advance announcement was for it.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Regardless of the underlying policy, I think what I'm troubled by is Senator Corcoran's comment about changing the law or clarifying the law in essence in the middle of a legal proceeding. It's just troubling to me. We have other bills floating around that are doing the same thing, and or at least doing the same thing on other issues. And so I guess I'd like you to respond a little bit to that comment about, you know, why should we as a legislature change the law or clarify the law while the case is in the middle of a court proceeding. Maybe the lawyer wants to respond to that.
I think I better let my attorney answer that question.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Richard Whitman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to testify with Oregon Department of Forestry on this bill. I have provided a brief written testimony on the effects, if you will, of this bill, which you should have before you. But, Madam Chair, let me go immediately to Senator Brown's question and try to respond to that, and then I want to come back and make a few remarks. The central allegation of the pending litigation is that where a state chooses to regulate in a particular area, and it does so in a manner that authorizes uses of property that violate federal law, the state is causing the violation of federal law. If that theory is correct, and we do not believe that it is, ultimately, we do not believe that that was Congress's intent when it enacted the Federal Endangered Species Act. But if that is true, then what we're talking about is avoiding a situation where state officers and the Board of Forestry were directed by this legislature to carry out a regulatory program are at risk of being liable for violating federal law. We don't want that situation to continue if there's any risk that that is in fact true. And that is the purpose, that is the fundamental purpose of this bill.
Madam Chair. Senator Brown and then Senator Burdick.
Just to follow up, I'm assuming, for example, DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, is the regulatory enforcer, for example, our Clean Air Act. I'm assuming that taken to extreme, one could sue DEQ in the event Portland is violating federal air quality standards.
This litigation and this theory of the case, if you will, is of concern to our office generally with regard to a whole host of state regulatory programs, going all the way from the Department of Environmental Quality and programs it administers under federal law to, you know, local government liability for administering our land use system or controls over people's use of fertilizer on their lawn. If the plaintiffs are correct, then states could and local government could be responsible for fully implementing a federal law to a degree that the federal agencies charged with administering that law have not chosen to do. And that is the situation we are trying to avoid.
Senator Birdie?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If you prevail in the lawsuit, as you indicated you thought you would, does the need for this bill go away?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, no, because I think even if this particular lawsuit were to go away, we may continue to have situations in the future where this lack of clarity about what the responsibility of the state forester and the State Board of Forestry are with regard to Forest Practices Act implementation will continue to cause disputes and likely litigation. So I think there's a long-term need for legislation clarifying what is the intent of the Oregon legislature here. If the Oregon legislature does intend for the Board of Forestry and the State Forester to be implementing the Federal Endangered Species Act, fine, say so expressly. If you don't, if that's not the intent of the legislature, then that should be clarified as is proposed in this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Is the case in federal court or state court?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, the case is in federal district court in Portland before Judge Anna Brown.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Not. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
Very much. Ray Wilkinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ray Wilkinson of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I appreciate this opportunity. I'll be very brief. I just want to make a brief statement on behalf of OFIC in support of this bill. I have to say our support is somewhat reluctant. We do not support amendments to the Forest Practices Act cavalierly. We have a great deal of respect for the Forest Practices Act and, frankly, wish this bill wasn't necessary. We do believe it is necessary based on some of the testimony you just heard. There are some fiscally corrosive effects of this lawsuit, both on the state and interveners. We are interveners. And this lawsuit is, in many people's eyes, frivolous and irresponsible. And I think a lot of people feel that way because it was filed over a year ago. And there's been tons of briefs written and oral arguments and hearings in front of the court. And there hasn't been a shred of evidence introduced yet of any actual violations of the Federal Endangered Species Act. So there's a lot of money being spent on a case that we really don't think justifies that. If I could, let me address some of the comments that Senator Corcoran did about, are you a regulator or aren't you? I think it's ironic that there's no higher law in the universe that says Oregon or any other state has to have a State Forest Practices Act or has to regulate the conduct of private forest landowners. Some states choose to do so. Some states choose not to do so. Our competition, frankly, comes mostly from states in the southeast, major timber-producing states who do not have Forest Practices Acts. This case could not be brought in those states. Oregon is a more enlightened and progressive place than those states, has chosen to have a Forest Practices Act, and therefore is vulnerable to this kind of litigation. So this can kind of be filed in the no good deed goes unpunished column. The other thing about how we view the act, if there's any suggestion that removing this technical prior approval authority will somehow lead to less compliance with the Forest Practices Act, I can assure you that's not the case. We support the Forest Practices Act. It was brought to this legislature 33 years ago by the forest industry. We have supported amendments that have upgraded it over the years. We will continue to comply with the rules, and if for the few of us who may not, there the enforcement mechanisms are in place to deal with those folks, and that's the way it should be. So, again, we wish this bill wasn't necessary. Unfortunately, we believe it is, and we would urge that you act on it as soon as possible.
Thank you, Ray. Any questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have
Mary from the Pacific Rivers Council, and Patty from Earth Justice, and Steve Cafori from the Audubon Society of Portland. And on deck, we will have Les Fethelson from the Native Fish Society. Hopefully, I haven't crucified any last names here. Good afternoon. Who's going to start first?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A good start. I'm used to doing that.
At his age, it's a glasses thing.
My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Audubon Society of Portland, which is one of the parties in the suit that you've heard about. I have with me Patty Goldman, who is the lead counsel in the suit from Earth Justice, and sitting next to me, and Mary Skrlock from Pacific Rivers Council to her right.
Okay. Whoever's going to start, go ahead and put your name on the record, please. And
yes, Madam Co-Chair, my name is Mary Skrlock. I'm Senior Policy Analyst with Pacific Rivers Council. We had planned to do a presentation, which, given the lateness of the hour, I will truncate somewhat and probably reformat a little bit in order to allow Ms. Goldman, who has traveled from Seattle, to be here today to respond to some of the earlier testimony. As you know, Pacific Rivers Council, Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Audubon Society of Portland, Coast Range Association, and Native Fish Society are involved in the lawsuit which is being targeted by this bill. They are all joining me in opposing this bill, as are at least 14 other organizations, and I will be submitting a letter that was submitted to the House into the record in that regard. We do believe that 3264 would substantively weaken Oregon's forest practice statute. It is deceptively simple. There is clearly a long history, as Assistant State Forester Stone referred to, and OFIC representative, to every piece of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. The prior approval requirement of the written plans near streams and resource sites was part of a hard-fought negotiation that I understand from 1987. The approval requirement was not lightly included, that there was a very conscious approval requirement included to distinguish the activities near streams and resource sites, other sensitive areas, from the other operations that simply are notified to the state forester. This is a proactive measure and should be retained. The timing of this action clearly sends a signal that if this were to pass, that the legislature may continue, is condoning the Board of Forestry's continuing to turn a blind eye to harm that may ensue from operations that it approves. And we believe clearly that, as a matter of policy, Endangered Species Act, sufficient state standards would unify and streamline regulatory requirements for landowners and provide greater regulatory certainty and protect landowners from both citizen and federal prosecution. That is what the lawsuit that we're involved in hopes to accomplish. I have Ms. Goldman here today. I'm going to go ahead and introduce the litigation very briefly because I gotten the impression in my discussions with representatives and senators on this that there is not a lot of information in the legislature, because up till now this lawsuit has not been discussed much in this forum. Basically, we are not the only ones who have pointed out that there are deficiencies in the Oregon Forest Practices Act when it comes to salmon protection. In 1995, the National Marine Fisheries Service, when they proposed to list coho, pointed out deficiencies. In fact, the Oregon Plan, when it was conceived in during 1997's refinements to that plan, promises were made to work with the National Marine Fisheries Service to develop forest practices that protect salmon habitat. And promises were made that changes would occur. This was prior to the coho listing. In fact, during the litigation that ensued over the coho listing, there were further findings made that, in fact, a major reason that the coho were ultimately listed is that the forest practices rules were not adequate to defer listing on that basis. There were subsequent proposals to improve forest practices rules. and Oregon responded by excluding the federal agency from the collaborative process that was initiated under the Oregon plan. And in fact, one of our frustrations and the main reason that we ultimately ended up in court is that the collaborative process did not actually address an issue that we felt was extremely important to the public natural resources of Oregon, which is what does the Endangered Species Act require for the recovery of endangered salmon. And the advisory committee did not address that issue, so we really cannot be criticized for trying to take another bite at an apple that we really had not had a shot at. We did encourage the state to do that. The Oregon's independent science team also joined in criticizing the rules. Some of these recommendations have been begun to be acted on. And since the coho listing, we have not seen changes in forest practices approval specifically to protect salmon. We've been joined as recently as 2001, 2002 by NIMS, Fish and Wildlife, and EPA in raising concerns about the forest practices rules. This is one quote from a document. And as recently as January of 2003, the Coastal Zone Management Program was deemed insufficient on the basis of the forest practices rules. Private lands in Oregon are extremely important to the survival of salmon. And as this is a map that illustrates the North Coast, where we have 70% of the land base is non-federal, and is a major impact on coho salmon. We've challenged very few and targeted practices under the forest practices rules. We do believe that the state has authority to prohibit these practices where there are concerns about endangered species. I'm just going to go through this list and turn it over to Ms. Goldman. We're concerned about logging along small streams. We're concerned about logging that triggers landslides that reach streams. And we're concerned about the sedimentation that degrades those streams when it reaches them, and the deprivation of the pieces of large wood that are very important to providing habitat. Patty?
My name is Patty Goldman. I am with Earth Justice. I am the lead lawyer in the case. Before I comment on the bill 3264, I want to respond to the statement that was made by Mr. Wilkinson that we have not submitted a shred of evidence or that this case is in any way frivolous. The state Forester and OFIC moved to dismiss on collectively about 10 grounds. That was fully briefed before the judge. She heard a half a day of hearing, and she rejected all of their arguments. In terms of evidence, we did introduce evidence on the logging in the landslide-prone areas. We had 7 expert declarations, and we profiled 14 logging operations that had been approved by the state forester where, if landslides occurred, they would reach coho salmon streams. There was plenty of evidence, and the judge, who is the independent neutral arbitrator here, found that the case is far from frivolous. I want to make 3 points in my comments. First, that this bill will not eliminate the litigation. It will just shift the target somewhat. Second, that it fails to deal with the underlying problem. And third, that there are significant public policy issues raised by this legislation that should be addressed before the legislature goes forward. In terms of the lawsuit, the assertion is being made that this bill will somehow eliminate the claims. That is not so. And in order to explain that, I want to explain the basis of the lawsuit. The Endangered Species Act prohibits any person from harming a listed species such as coho salmon. That applies to private individuals, to state entities, to federal officials. All of them are bound not to harm coho salmon. And that harm can happen directly by being the entity that does the logging, or by being a local government, a state government, a federal government that authorizes the activity. There have been cases in other courts of appeals. Every single one has found that government regulators can be liable when they authorize an activity that causes take. That is the theory of this case, and so far the district judge has held that that is a viable theory, and that the state forester, the only defendant to date, does authorize these activities through approvals. If this bill goes through, the state forester will no longer authorize these activities. It will be the Board of Forestry that does it through its regulations. We have already sent a notice to add the Board of Forestry to the case. This will simply shift the defendant to the Board of Forestry. We have the 60-day notice that is available, so you can see that we are serious about bringing the Board of Forestry into the case. The other parties may argue then that the case isn't viable. That will be before the judge, and she will decide that, likely in early 2004. My second point is that this bill fails to deal with the underlying problem. The underlying problem is the kinds of logging practices that are authorized under the rules and through the state foresters' implementation of those rules. Senator Corcoran had asked a question about whether the state has ever exercised its authority to stop logging that would violate federal law, and he answered no. The answer is actually slightly different. What the state has done is decided that it has ample authority under state law to protect endangered species through its requirements to protect resource sites, which include habitat for threatened and endangered species. It got an expert opinion from the Attorney General's office to that effect for the northern spotted owl, and it adopted special rules identifying resource sites for the northern spotted owl. It has brought state regulation of forestry into compliance with the Endangered Species Act for other species, but not for coho salmon. It has done no resource site inventories or protections for coho salmon. And the third point I want to make is that there are significant issues of public policy that need to be addressed before this kind of shift is made. The first is, it is bizarre for a state regulator to decide it wants less authority, that it wants the legislature to say the state forester has no authority to impose any requirements when it reviews and now approves logging on private lands. In the past, the state forester has established requirements in the course of its approval that have become part of the written plan. It may be that those are in the form of implementing or interpreting the rules, but they then become binding concrete requirements. And because the rules require compliance with written plans, they're enforceable. In addition, what this bill would do is shift the burden to the department's enforcement resources. Today, the state forester must approve the practices before they can go forward. And if he doesn't, then the landowner or the operator must appeal and cannot log that area until it gets approval, either from the state forester or the board. Under this bill, what would happen is once the review period of 14 days is over, the logging could occur. If there is a problem with compliance with the state rules or with resource damage, the entire burden shifts to the state to use its scarce enforcement resources to go bring a proceeding against that landowner or operator to stop the logging from occurring. In other words, the default is all logging can occur until the state forester proves otherwise and the Board of Forestry stops it through an enforcement proceeding. And given limited enforcement proceedings, that doesn't make sense to shift the burden that way and allow the damage to the resource to take place. And finally, the state has the resources and the expertise to establish minimum standards that can protect coho salmon and allow the logging to go forward. By trying to take itself out of the role, which we do not believe it can legally do, but in its view, it believes it will take itself out of the Endangered Species Act liability box, it is placing the burden on private companies, many of whom will not have those kinds of resources, to come up with the standards that will protect coho, and there can be a competitive advantage from having weaker standards. And so what you could have is companies trying to have weaker protections in order to gain that kind of competitive advantage. We urge the committee not to let this bill go forward.
Thank you. Stephen, did you have anything further? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. A couple questions. In your point number three, you made the statement something to the effect that, and I didn't write it down, I'd ask about this to the tape, but I took it as meaning that if we do this, we'll allow people to be innocent until proven guilty. And that's the standard, you think, that people should be guilty until they prove themselves innocent?
Well, the state forester has expertise And a responsibility as somebody who doesn't have the financial interest in logging a site to look at the resource impacts of a particular operation. In the past, and the review's only a two-week time, if he finds a problem, then he would not approve the operation until a change is made in the written plan, and then it is enforceable. What will happen now is if he finds a problem and he notifies the landowner or the operator and they decide not to comply and not to make the change, the logging will go forward, and often very quickly. So the state forester will have to go use his enforcement resources to initiate an enforcement proceeding to stop that logging from going forward. It does shift the dynamic, and so instead of being cannot go forward till it is properly determined to comply with the state rules, it will be the opposite. It can go forward until the state proves that it does not comply with the state rules.
So exactly, to be innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, I guess the state forester in either instance would decide guilt, if you want to put it that way, or lack of compliance. It's just
the concept to be to shift to that. That's amazing. One more question, Madam Chair. You're from Washington?
Yes, I am.
Have you sued the Washington DNR yet?
The Washington did bring into place much greater protections for salmon on private logging. We did challenge those for not going far enough, but they are far superior to what is in place in Oregon.
Well, what I heard you say was that any state regulator that allows the take of an endangered species can be subject to suit or prosecution. Is that what you said?
Yeah, and that is why the state of Washington did come up with much better forest practices regulations.
Well, the state of Washington allows fishing and killing for these fish, endangered species, all the time.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
The state of Washington allows fishing for these fish all the time, they're endangered species.
That is completely beyond my knowledge to be able to respond. I don't know. I don't have any information about that.
Forest Practices Program, we're quite well aware of the requirements in Washington, but the harvest management rules, we've not.
So you're going after a state where there's no evidence to show that we've ever hurt an endangered species. There's no dead fish, yet there are dead fish all the time from fishing, and there's no suits. I don't get it.
Respectfully, Madam Chairperson and Senator Beyer, the forest practices impacts were a reason. Cited reason for the listing of the coastal coho salmon. So habitat degradation caused by timber harvest was found to be a contributing factor, a major contributing factor to the decline of these salmon. So we have credible findings that fish have been killed by logging.
What is the status of that listing now?
It's currently in place and under review with all of the other listings.
I thought there was a judge that said that it was listed improperly and that they had to go back and start over.
That decision was stayed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we argued that case last week, and the panel was indicating that they may well keep that stay in place while the entire listing issue is reviewed by the agencies in the federal government.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, Senator Beyer. Thank you very much. And the next panel is Les Helgeson and Aubrey Russell. Les, the Native Fish Society, and Aubrey from Oregon Trout. And for those of you that are waiting for the next bill, as long as I don't lose Senator Beyer, I'll stay with you so we can get that hearing over with and have a possible work session if we're ready on agreement. So, pardon me? That's all right. I'll take the testimony. Go ahead and go if you have to. Okay. Will you go ahead and introduce yourselves to the record, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer. My name is Les Helgeson. I'm here representing Native Fish Society. We are one of the plaintiffs in the suit, and we're strongly opposed to this bill and urge you not to consider it any further. The bill is bad not only for fish and wildlife, but forest landowners as well. I'd like to incorporate the comments of the Pacific Rivers Council by reference, and I think Ms. Goldman addressed some of our other concerns in the written testimony here. I think it's interesting to see the attempt at creating a forest practices advisory role for the state forester and simply transfer it onto the Board of Forestry. But another issue that I'd like to address is the consequence of this legislation would be a resultant weakening of the Forest Practices Act. And I suspect NOAA Fisheries would likely take a greater role in overseeing Oregon's role in recovery of endangered species, specifically coastal coho, where I live. And currently, the service is deferred to the state in good faith, relying on provisions of the Oregon Plan and revisions, promised revisions to the Forest Practices Act, among other things. But this legislation takes a substantial step backwards in proactive ESA legislation, protection, excuse me, and will risk increased oversight by federal agencies charged with enforcing the Endangered Species Act. And as a small woodland owner myself, I'm concerned about that prospect. And the alternative, I urge you to strengthen the Forest Practices Act in a manner that would improve our efforts at watershed recovery while maintaining economically viable forest operations. And I'd be happy to provide any suggestions for you based upon many years of personal experience as a natural resource consultant, landowner, and conservation activist. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I really do appreciate, I know you've shortened your testimony a great deal, and I appreciate that, and your testimony and information has all been handed out.
Thank you.
Next.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, Aubrey Russell with the Oregon Trout. Oregon Trout is not a member, it's not a party to this litigation. Oregon Trout is a membership organization. We have over 1,000 currently active members throughout Oregon who have an interest in Oregon's clean waters and healthy fishable fish populations. We certainly understand and appreciate the challenge inherent in balancing the need to provide timber production with the need of preserving our state's investment in naturally reproducing fish populations. And we recognize also that the aspect of this challenge, this balance between production and fish recovery and protection that has regrettably attracted the most attention is this threat of intervention by the federal courts in order to force compliance with the federal environmental laws. Oregon Trout does not feel that the best way to meet this threat, which the Attorney General has just said is not really a credible threat, is for the state to abdicate its role in resource management and planning and to abdicate its commitment or to cease its commitment to a sustainable economy. What HB 3264 does is envision a hands-off approach for the Department of Forestry at a time when this approach puts in jeopardy some ongoing efforts to cooperate in a broad-scale, consensus-based, statewide conservation planning effort, which will lead, hopefully, to a 4D limit. Oregon Trout has been active with others in this legislature and around the state in attempting to bring this about. This bill takes us dramatically in the wrong direction. If we're looking to manage our resource responsibly, we should have ODF assuming a greater role in managing harvest and approving timber plans. Oregon should be providing leadership as well as enforceable conditions in its approval of the forest harvest plans. This leadership helps individual operators and gives them assurances that their investment in responsible planning will not be undone by others in their watershed whose approach to resource management may be more short-term and may be less considerate of the ultimate ability of the watershed to sustainably yield healthy levels of cut. This bill would weaken the ODF's ability to inspect proposed harvest and approve them in a way which is consistent with rebuilding our fish populations and ultimately providing a sustainable yield. I've submitted written testimony. I appreciate your consideration. With that, I'll end my testimony.
Thank you, and we have handed it out, and we'll get the other committee members the testimony of both of you gentlemen. Any questions? Thank you very much. And I thank you for making your testimony brief. I appreciate it very much. I will close the... Yes, Senator?
Anyone else to sign up to testify?
Did I miss somebody? I don't...
Well, I'm just curious. I received a letter from the governor on Friday indicating his support of the bill and signing the bill as soon as he receives it. And I would just hopefully be someone from the governor's staff here to testify in favor of the bill.
Well, I know the governor's not here because he's in Japan. Is anybody here? Is anyone here from the governor's office to testify about the bill that he had in support of this issue?
That's unclear. That letter I have is not officially signed.
Madam Chair, I've got an official signed letter from the governor, so.
I have a message on my answering machine that says it's a clerical error.
Yes.
Charlie Stone again for the Department of Forestry. I have been in touch with the governor's Natural Resource Office frequently over the last couple of days, and the governor's office did indicate that they had intended to pull that letter back, that it was signed by an auto pen and was not the governor's intent to sign that letter, that he intended to remain neutral until such time as there had been a hearing before the Senate panel.
Thank you. So the letter of support was premature.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I guess I just, you know, I get a letter delivered to my box that says the governor's supporting the bill. I would assume that means, and that's got a signature on it. I guess I assume that the governor's supporting the bill. So we'll get that clarified by the governor's staff when he's here, and they want to come see us, huh?
But not tonight.
Not tonight.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3264 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2763. Hasina, Rem, and is there anyone else?
Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 2763 sets the filing fees for including candidate portraits and statements in a county voter's pamphlet.
Don't let the size of this panel overwhelm you.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we are honored to have the ability to stay and listen to the fabulous testimony of your committee, and thank you for bearing with us, and we'll be very brief. House Bill 2763 has been introduced at the request of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, Oregon School Boards Association, Oregon Community College Association, in response to what occurred in February of 2002, which was the adoption of an administrative rule at the Secretary of State's office at the request to the county clerks in an effort for them to find additional funding for county voter pamphlets. We are supportive of county voter pamphlets. In the past, prior to the adoption of the administrative rule, the filing fee for unpaid candidates was $25, a flat fee in exchange, well, not in exchange for that, just by virtue of the way special districts, community colleges, and school boards pay the full cost of their elections. There is a portion of the voter pamphlet that is allocated to them based upon the number of candidates that are running for election, and so we pay the full cost of those voter pamphlets. The administrative rule increased the fee in some instances to $300. We feel that that is excessive and have introduced this piece of legislation to roll back those fees back to the $25 level. The -1 amendment, which you should have before you, would subject the city candidates to the higher fees that were proposed in the administrative rule, because this would truly make it, in fact, a revenue-neutral proposal with the -1 with the county clerks.
Thank you. Rim, am I saying your name correctly?
You are. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, Rem Nivens, Oregon Community College Association, and just briefly here to support House Bill 2763. The main issue for us is that we do have a difficult time at times recruiting board members for our colleges, but they serve a very important role for our colleges. They are very important in terms of oversight and budgeting, and we were concerned because we don't want to create any additional barriers to their ability or desire to participate in that process, and we feel that if a larger increase in voters' pamphlet fees could very well do that. And so I was also asked by John Marshall to get on the record that the Oregon School Boards Association is also in support of the bill. I've submitted written testimony, which you can review, and be happy to answer any questions if you have any. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. I guess I don't have any questions. Jim, do you have any questions?
Would you like to question somebody? You feel like you'd like to question somebody.
Do you want to invite the opponents to come forward?
I will as soon as we're... Yeah. No questions. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And next we have Al Davidson, Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Al Davidson, Marion County Clerk, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Thank you for staying and letting us get through this. The County Clerks Association opposed this bill in the House, and as it's written, we would still oppose it. The Dash 1 amendments make it revenue neutral, and so we withdraw our opposition. In that case, we still believe that these are matters better left to administrative rule, but apparently we're going down a different road here. So we are neutral on it. The issue then becomes for the legislature the policy of how much do the taxpayers subsidize political speech through voter pamphlets, and local governments here have indicated their willingness to increase that subsidy by lowering the fees, and so that's a policy issue best left to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
So your position is going to be neutral?
Neutral.
Really rather not have the bill, but you'd remain neutral?
Remain neutral, yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jim, anything but to come before the committee?
You have completed your agenda for today.
No wonder I'm tired then. Yes, John, come on up. Come on up. The man waving frantically at the back of the room is from the Secretary of State's office. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I thought Fred Neal had signed up. I'm here because he had to go home early. We are also...
I know you, John, but I better have your name
sorry.
On the record.
John Lindback, Director of Elections, Secretary of State's office. Our position on the Dash 1 amendments is the same as the clerks. However, I would like to reiterate one thing. What this bill does and what the effect of the Dash 1 amendments is to create some anomalies. For the special districts, the taxpayers of the special districts will be paying the bulk of the bill for candidates to be in a voter's pamphlet. City candidates, not city taxpayers, will pay the bill to be in the voter's pamphlet. And under the Dash 1 amendments, taxpayers of the counties will pay the bulk of the bill for county candidates to be in a county voter's pamphlet. And ahead of us is a probably unpleasant discussion about how to pay for the state voter's pamphlet, in which we are looking at some substantial fee increases for state candidates to appear in a state voter's pamphlet. And what it looks like we're marching down the road here is, by passage of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments, some serious differences and anomalies and lack of uniformity on who pays what in terms of the burden placed on candidates.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. Okay. Thank you, John. Anything further? If not, thank you very much. We are adjourned. It's the first time I've ever conducted a hearing where I'm the only one here. We need to bring this up in rules if there really wasn't consensus. Now, I mean, it looks to me like that the special is supposed to pull me kind of a whizzy on you. Okay.